It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
There are around 40 lynchings that remain open cases in the state of Maryland. Two of the most famous occurred on the Eastern Shore in Princes Anne and in Salisbury. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Governor Larry Hogan signed the nation's first Truth and Reconciliation legislation. It is aimed in part at providing opportunity to heal the wounds for the families whose relatives fell victim to the crime and those whose descendants may have participated in them. In Princes Anne, it was 1931 when a young black man named George Armwood was accused of attacking an elderly white woman. 2 years later, in 1933, Matthew Williams was accused of shooting and killing his employer. Both were lynched. On the phone with us is James Yamakau, who has focused his attention on Matthew Williams. And hopefully in a few minutes, we will also have Tina Johnson, who is related to George Armwood and is also involved in the efforts by the commission. And welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
So tell me then a little bit, let's start with Matthew Williams and describe for me what it was like in 1931 when Matthew Williams found himself being accused of shooting and killing his employer.
Well, 1931, it was December 4th, 1931. It was just a few months after the what do we call the near lynching of Yule Lee, otherwise known as Orphan Jones, out in Berlin. He had been accused of murdering, you know, like a white family, white farmer, farm family living in Berlin. And the authorities managed to get him off the shore, and so the tension in the area was fairly high because people felt like they had not got the quote-unquote justice that they felt they deserved. So the tensions were high, and just a few months later was when Matthew Williams was lynched.
So what was the reaction then in terms of the community, in terms of the aftermath? Because obviously you had both whites, who some of whom participated or whose relatives had watched this lynching occur. And on the other hand, you have African-Americans who have to live side by side and in some cases are employed by these very same white folks in Salisbury.
Salisbury, like, you know, in Sherrilyn Ifill's book on the courthouse lawn, estimates of anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 people witnessed or participated in the lynching of Matthew Williams. That was roughly 10% of the population of Salisbury at the time. So imagine, like, you know, a group of 100 people, 10 of those people then. So chances are that even if you weren't at the lynching of Matthew Williams, you knew someone who was, or you related to someone who was. And so imagine, like, you know, having firsthand knowledge that someone you knew, someone you could have been very close to, either actively took part or did nothing to stop this happening. And then imagining, like, you know, again, having to, being an African-American, like, in Salisbury at the time, having to go to work with these people. Again, there's no way you could not have known people who would have taken part.
I also understand that at one point somebody had shouted in the crowd that that Williams actually hadn't shot him, that the son was actually to blame.
Yeah, there's not, like, again, the official story, and again, I put that in quotes, the official story is that Matthew Williams shot his employer, Daniel J. Elliott, over a wage dispute. There is another story that's floating around, again, it's in Sherrilyn Ifill's book and others as well, that Matthew Williams, who was noted as being a very thrifty person, he saved a lot of his money. He wanted to make sure he had enough money to save for his future. He had lent the money to Daniel Elliott's son, James Elliott. And when James Elliott refused to pay it back, Matthew Williams went to his boss, Daniel, to ask him to entreat his son to return the money. Then the son proceeded to shoot them both. Again, now we don't know this if this happened. This is the unofficial story. But the thing is, no one knows what happened because no trial was ever had for Matthew Williams because they lynched him before anything could happen.
Now, the other thing that struck me, particularly we were walking around downtown Salisbury, is that there was a hotel at one point, it's now, I think it's the One Plaza East, in which a number of African-Americans were employed, and obviously many of them probably were looking on as this event occurred just almost across the street.
So some of the workers at the hotel were brought out to the balcony of the Wicomico Hotel, and I mean, the hotel literally is you could like throw a stone from the hotel and hit the courthouse lawn. It's very, very close. They were basically trapped there. They couldn't try to get home, because if they did, the mob might get them too. And like, you know, I found out there was kind of an unofficial curfew put in place. And in the days following Matthew Williams, another black man who had gone out to get food, like, you know, because they like that was found by a white mob and beaten to death. They know he was going out to get food because they found like half a ham wrapped in brown paper next to him. Like, he had just gone out to get food, and a mob that apparently hadn't been satiated with the blood of Matthew Williams needed to go out and get someone else.
When I now turn to Tina Johnson and George Armwood, who was lynched in 1933. And Tina, you are obviously related to Armwood. Tell me how you discovered that, A, that you were related, and this whole story about him.
I want to say I was around about 12 years old, and a cousin of mine, he was incarcerated up in Pennsylvania, and he was incarcerated because he got into an argument with his girlfriend, who at the time was a white lady, and she didn't press charges on him. However, the state did, and then he was found guilty for a domestic dispute, and he was actually sentenced like 5 years in prison. And according to the both of them, he never laid hands on her. They were literally just arguing in public. So I remember my grandmother, like when we had told her about it, and she was just like, yes, another black man, you know, being pretty much lynched because of the fact that he was associated with a white woman. And I had looked at her and I was just like, what are you talking about? So that's when she started to tell me. She was like, I had a cousin and he was killed. And then I was like, he was killed. And then she went on to tell me that his name was George. And she said she was around about 10 or 12. And he had came home one day and he came in the house and he started like screaming, I didn't do it, I didn't do it. And she said at the time she didn't know what was going on, but he ran in the house and he told his mother, Mom, I didn't do it, I didn't do it. And then, you know, she tried to calm him down and they was like, what's going on? And he was like, they're trying to say I killed a white lady and I didn't do it. And then, you know, she said that, you know, she thought that she had heard him say, I was just trying to help her, I didn't do it. And then all he kept saying was that he didn't do it. And then, so his mother had told him that, you know, he needed to go talk to his white people. Because at the time, even though they weren't technically slaves, he was a slave. He was owned by another white family that lived pretty much across the field from them, not too far from where they lived, so they could technically see each other from a distance. And he actually ended up living with them because he had gotten into some more trouble a while back before all of this had happened, and he had gotten him out of trouble. So to pay him off, it was one of those things where now I own you. And my grandmother, you know, she was telling me that later on that evening, they were all like, they seen the police and everything. They came down there and then they watched him drag him out of the woods. And then they tied him to the back of a car and then started making him kind of like walk or run or whatever you want to call it behind the car. And she was saying that was the last time she had seen her cousin. And then, you know, she was saying like a couple days later, you know, they had told her mom, well, her aunt, technically, they had told her aunt that, you know, he was killed. And, you know, she didn't believe it at the time because she didn't actually know what was going on. All of it was more like hearsay. So she wasn't actually told until after the fact, when the police and the news and everything, they came there and they confirmed that he was killed. My grandmother was saying that, you know, like after they killed him, they drug him through the black neighborhoods, you know, kind of just to let them know that, you know, they were their superior. That was mostly what my grandmother had told me. And I want to say I was probably about 10 to 12 then when she had told me that. And then at the time I was like, you know, But Grandma, that's not true. You know, slavery was over a long time ago. And I guess, you know, when you start and think about it, it wasn't that long ago.
Right.
You know, so when I went to college, I went to Salisbury University, and I was taking a Maryland history course. And the only reason why I took the course was because my best friend, she had told me that she was going to take the course with me. And she was like, oh, it's going to be an easy A. We know everything about Maryland. Needless to say, we didn't know anything about Maryland.
Right.
So, you know, we get in the course and I was thinking, oh, my goodness, the reading, we had to read so much. And I'm like, wow, there's tons of stuff that happened in Maryland. But then it got to this one little blurb and this entire textbook that we were reading. And it was like talking about lynchings, but it was like one paragraph. And all it said was that the last person lynched in the state of Maryland was George Armwood. And then I remember like seeing that and just freezing. I don't know what the professor said after that. You know, he said a ton of stuff before and after. And I remember just being frozen on that one little blurb. And then it saying George Armwood. And I remember he stopped for a second. And he was like, anyone have any questions? And I remember like raising my hand and saying that was my cousin. And I remember the entire room got silent. Like there was no word said. And remind you, like I said, I went to Salisbury University. There's not many Black people at Salisbury University. In fact, majority of my classes, it was probably like myself and maybe two others. It just so happened that on that day, the other person that was Black in my class wasn't there. So I'm going, ooh, this is a little awkward. Right. And the professor was like, oh, maybe you should do your research paper on it. But I also remember him not wanting to talk about it also. Mm. Which made me want to talk about it more. So I guess that's kind of where I'm at today.
So now he was lynched, but then they, as you said, they dragged his body. But he was also hung from a telephone pole?
Yeah. So basically the first night that he was there, you know, the mob came and they gathered around the jailhouse and they wanted him, but they ended up sending him up to like Cecil and then into Baltimore. Of course, they argued to get him back. So once they got him back in Somerset County, you know, a mob came once again. The judge was just like, you know, I know you guys, like we know each other. And I guess that was kind of like the whole little warning, like I can see you, we see each other. But, you know, so later on, of course, he went home, he had dinner, which he told everyone he was going home to have dinner. He has guests coming. And even though it was like one of those warnings, like, I can see you, I know who you are. But, in my mind, it was kind of more like the more I did my research on it, it was more like, no, I'm not telling you, I know who you are, as in I can convict you. It was more like, I just want to try to throw that out there that I can. However, I'm going home to have dinner, so I don't technically see you anymore. It was kind of like giving them the go ahead. And then so basically later on that evening, they all came back. They broke into the jailhouse and they beat him and they drug him. They pulled him out of the jail cell and down the stairs. And once they got out of the stairs, they beat him some more. I believe somewhere I had read that, you know, like they had stabbed him in the eye and it was just basically they brutalized his body. And in other things I had read that they believed that he might have even been dead before they drug him out the stairs, I mean, down the stairs, that it was possible that they had beat him so badly in the jail cell that he was already dead. So once they had pulled him out, they beat him, they burned him, they hung him. They were going to hang him in the judge's yard. However, they decided to hang him like across the street, sort of, across from the judge's house. And they hung him there. And then after that, they cut him down. They drug him around the streets. And then they hung him again in front of the courthouse on a light pole, where then they set the body on fire. And of course, you know, after they had burned him, they cut him down again. And then they threw him in front of the, Hayman's? They threw him in front of Hayman's in Somerset County.
So when you finally began to discover this, what was your own personal or emotional reaction to this? And especially, did it affect the way, as you kind of looked around your town again, how you related to the town?
Yeah, I would definitely say it changed my way on how I looked at things, especially because I still live in Somerset County. I still live in Prince's Anne, where all these things have happened. And it just started making me remember, like, the little things as I was growing up that my parents would always tell me. I remember, like, my grandma saying one time, like, oh, this is the lynching tree. And then I was like, what in the world does she mean by that? And then she would always say, you know, someone was lynched there. And instead of them tearing this tree down, they just built the sidewalk around it. And then I remember, because I remember, like, walking on that sidewalk so many times and thinking, why in the world is this tree in the middle of the sidewalk? And then, you know, it was just like some of those little things that was told to me as I was growing up that I didn't pay attention to, that as now that I look around, it's just like little flashes of memory. And then every time, of course, I ride down the street, down Somerset Ave, where majority of these things have happened. And at certain times, I see, it's like, oh, man, it looks so pretty down here. And then I start to remember all the blood that was on the streets. And then I've been asked, like, plenty of times, like, why don't you just leave Somerset? There's nothing there. And I'm like, because my family bled on these streets, and I have every right to be there. I mean, and still till this day, there's definitely still some prejudice there. You can definitely feel the vibes.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then, and there's certain places that I just won't go. And that's just because, you know, like, you walk into certain places and it's just like, you don't belong here. The words aren't said, but the feeling is felt, if that makes any sense.
Did you feel that as much before you learned about this as opposed to afterwards?
I would say that it was probably always there. It was probably just more along the lines of where you didn't pay attention to it before. Because there was just like times when I was younger that we would go places and then, you know, we would be in there and then it's all of a sudden my mom's like, let's go. And I'm like, but we didn't get what we were coming for. And then it's like, it's okay, let's go. So now it's just like, I guess being more aware of it, I would say now. Than whereas before, where I was kind of just, I guess, blind to it.
James, the thing that strikes me about, obviously, about both lynchings is that it wasn't just simply about a single act or a single violation, as it were, of law or otherwise, but that they were trying to send a message to the African-American community. In case of Matthew Williams, they dragged him through the street in front of the African-American community, as well as a whole ritual of cutting off his fingers and so on. I mean, this was a major social event, not just simply something that was specific to a specific act.
Well, yeah. And before I go on, I do want to, like, you know, echo and reiterate what Tina said about this stuff not being very long ago. Coming up this May 25th is the 121st anniversary of Garfield King. He was the first lynched in Salisbury back in 1898. But, like, you know, you just like he said that George Armwood was essentially a slave, like, you know, owned by someone else. You know, slavery was abolished in 1865. We have a prison industrial complex where people are kept as basically as slaves in the prison system. School segregation was outlawed in 1954, Brown versus Board. Schools are now even more segregated now. You know, you have Civil Rights Act passed, and now there's a massive voter suppression. And again, lynchings declined with the rise of capital punishment by the state. But now you have, you know, instances of police brutality that have a lot of the thematic similarities. So it's like, it's the past, but it's not really the past. But going back to what you're asking about, the kind of the way these things were done, you're right, they were public spectacles. Now some of this, like with George Armwood, I could be wrong. It was like maybe 2,000-3,000 people, Tina.
Yes, it was. I think they said it was like 2,500 to 3,000.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, again, a significant chunk of the population of the town at the time. Even if some of it came out of town, it's still a lot of the town. Like, you know, some places in the South had like 20,000-30,000 people come to these things.
Like they were community events. They brought their families. They brought picnic lunches. They had postcards, like made of the lynchings and mailed out to their friends and family. It's like, look at the barbecue we attended. And I mean, you can imagine the kind of callousness and lack of empathy that shows. Like, so, but yeah, like these were essentially ritual murders because again, like, you know, the similarities between George Armwood and Matthew Williams, they both were drugged through the streets. They were hung multiple times in some cases. Oftentimes they were shot or stabbed. The bodies were mutilated. In the end, they were burned as some kind of sacrifice, in a sense. Like, you know, I hate even saying that because like, you know, it's not to condone it, saying that there's almost like a ritualistic nature behind it. And that's part of what describes, you know, lynching culture as a whole. It's a ritual murder in the name of white supremacy in order to keep black people in their place. And like I said, like they dragged the bodies through the neighborhood. It was meant as a form of domestic terrorism, as a method of social control, saying we can do anything we want. Like we as white people can do anything we want to you, and you can't do anything about it. And the lack of accountability both then and now kind of shows.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that there were people in the crowd that would not have done this except for the fact that they were in this crowd, this mob?
There's what's the current hashtag? Not all white people. Of course, there were people in the crowd who felt like they couldn't do anything about it, but they were still there. And there is something about a mob mentality where if enough people do something, you feel like you can't speak out against it. Look at, I'm sure not all, like, you know, like Germans in the Nazi era were, like, you know, actively saying, I'm going to go out and commit genocide against a whole group of people. But they were still part of the system that made that let it happen. The people in the crowd for Matthew Williams and George Armwood and all of the lynchings across the country, there are people who were more likely against it, but they felt like they felt for some reason, whatever reason they had in their heart and their mind at the time, they felt they couldn't do anything about it. They felt that because there were family members or neighbors in the crowd that were actually cheering on the lynching, that they couldn't speak out against them for fear of being ostracized in their own community. That's one of the ways that white supremacy perpetuates itself, is by keeping the people who might speak out against it silent. And so that in a lot of ways, I mean, this is not to downplay the damage and the terror and the violence put against the black community, but there is some sense damage done to the white community as well. It's not the same scale by any stretch of the imagination, but the psychological trauma of witnessing this and being forced to stay silent about it causes probably repercussions that people aren't really aware of.
Tina, well, we now have this Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This process is kind of supposed to take place over the next 3 years. What do you hope to see out of it?
I hope to see that, you know, more conversations, more discussions, more education in the school systems as well. Because I feel as though, like, the school systems, they educate you, but they only educate you on a certain past. They tend to leave out any type of like negative things, especially when it comes to the African American community. The schools aren't necessarily teaching our children about our past. They like to leave out the past. And I'm assuming it's probably because of the fact that it is so harsh. But we need to be educated on those things. You can't necessarily move forward without being able to address the past, because we all know that history repeats itself. So if we continue to ignore it, then it's just going to happen all over again. And like, just like James was saying, you know, these were spectacles and there were mothers and children at these events. You know, this was just like a family barbecue. You know, these were literally just like street events. They were fairs, if you want to say, you know, everyone was there. So we have to educate the children And not just the African-American children. We have to educate all the children. So we know the effect that has happened over these years. You know, there's so much anger. And even though these things didn't happen to us in today's age, but, you know, we still have to, I guess, reap the repercussions of all the things that have happened in the past. You know, we have to experience the fear that our elders have passed down to us. You know, when we're growing up, you know, our parents are telling us all the things we can't do in public and the reason why we can't do it in public. And 9 times out of 10, it's more along the lines because, you know, it's not white enough. You know, I have to put quotation marks around that. Because when I was growing up, I remember everyone would always say, oh, you act white. And I'm going, how do I act a certain color or race? And basically, you know, it's just because of the way that we carry ourselves. So if we don't carry ourselves a certain way, then we're not looked upon as everyday, like, human beings. I like to say it's definitely like a human being. We're not seen as all the other human beings. And even though the word lynching has technically been abolished, you know, we still have lynchings today. Like, you know, like James was saying, all the police brutality, those are in the same, if you look up the definition of lynching, they all fall in that exact same category. You know, we have all of these African-American men being killed on the streets and such a brutal way. And, you know, and now with social media and everything else, you know, these things are now being televised a lot more. So, and like with George Armwood, because it was so brutal, that's the reason why the law was passed, because it was, everyone seen it, everyone heard about it. There was, you know, people were there, they were talking about it. It was just so horrible that it was like, oh no, we can't have this. And I feel like with all of this coming up, hopefully it's able to continue to tell everyone, no, we can't have this. Like, this has to end. You know, we have to do our education from the past so that we can start moving forward and correcting the things that we have going on now in our present and make a better future.
I'll turn to you, James. Because I'm curious about what you hope to get out of this, particularly for Salisbury. And I know just to note, for instance, that the Maryland legislature failed to pass, I think it was in 1898, an anti-lynching law. The Senate eventually, I think it was the Congress, I think eventually apologized for the lynchings. That enough? I mean, or what do we need to do here?
Well, just the fact that, like, you know, both the Maryland House and the Maryland Senate, as well as the governor, all passed and signed HB 307, establishing a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, an official one. The first one in the nation, actually. I believe it is the first official one statewide in the nation. What that's going to do is go around the different locations in the state of Maryland that had these lynchings, and most of them have groups within them that are either in the process or have been doing the work of memorializing and educating and advocating for the memory of these victims. Here in Wicomico, that's the Wicomico Truth and Reconciliation Initiative. That is a group formed out of members from other groups. Like, you know, the work has been going on for a while now. We collected members from the former Surge Del Marva group, Phoenix Youth Project, the SUNAACP, EJI came up, and we took the soil samples from the 7 lynching sites in Wicomico and Somerset, starting with Tina leading the one for George Armwood. And we've done vigils. We've taken part in the statewide Maryland Lynching Memorial Project Conference. That's a statewide nonprofit that a lot of these groups are working with as kind of like, you know, go-betweens between us and the Equal Justice Initiative out of Montgomery, Alabama. So the work is, there's a sense of urgency, I want to say, that history is turning here, that we're finally becoming aware of, I mean, I guess more aware of our history. Like, I guess the point is that people, in some senses, people were not taught this history, and in other senses, they were taught the sentiment behind that history, which is why, you know, people aren't supposed to go certain places. Why people like it, so it's. I guess the it's a moment in time that I think is right to talk about this.
Well, we've been speaking with Tina Johnson, who is related to George Armwood, who was lynched in Prince's Anne. Also, James Yamakawa has been involved with the focusing his attention on Matthew Williams and the lynching that took place in Salisbury. Probably leave us with one comment, actually, by Desmond Tutu out of South Africa, who is quoted as saying, "If one person is dehumanized, then we are all diminished and dehumanized in our turn." Those are the thoughts of Desmond Tutu and the aftermath of apartheid in South Africa. This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. There are more acts coming to Salisbury for the National Folk Festival this fall. Welcome to Del Marva Today. This is Don Rush. Organizers say they've expanded the broad range of the grassroots folk traditions for the 79th annual event. One group from Port-au-Prince combines Haiti's traditional music with its spiritual message and throws in some rock and R&B elements. Another echoes the sound of Mahalia Jackson with a gospel group from Virginia. And a bluegrass act will be heard with classic sounds from the Blue Ridge Mountains. And finally, it's traditional Iraqi music from a one-time political refugee who evokes the experiences of his homeland and his time as an exile. This will be the second year of the event in Salisbury. There have been around 15 acts announced so far. In our studio this morning is Caroline O'Hare. She's the local manager for the festival. And on the phone with us is Julie Olin. She's the artistic director with the National Council for the Traditional Arts. And well, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let me turn to you, Caroline. And so where are we in terms of preparations? How quickly are things picking up? What do things look like, particularly compared to, say, last year?
It's a very fast pace, but it's a run that we have done, and we're familiar with the course, so we're enjoying it. It is fast-paced. We've already selected the artisans and craftspeople for our festival marketplace. We'll be announcing them in the coming weeks, and as well as our food vendors have been selected, and we're working with contracts and things like that. And then also our volunteers have the opportunity to start signing up for shifts at the end of this month. We will launch our Get Connected portal, and we're very excited for that. So if you'd like to be in the know, be sure to like us on Facebook or subscribe for updates on our website at nationalfolkfestival.com. We'll keep you informed, and you'll know when all the things are happening.
By the way, what kind of things would the volunteers be doing?
Sure. We have a multitude of tasks and help that's needed, from the festival desk that interacts with artists at the hotel, to backstage assistance, to running ice and water, helping sell merchandise, just a whole host of things.
And how many volunteers do you think you're going to need? And how does that compare to, say, last year?
Last year, we'll have approximately the same amount of volunteers that we'll need. Last year, we had, I believe, over 1,200 people volunteer. We have a lot of slots. We're also streamlining our volunteer shifts and listening to comments and ideas from last year, so that this year will go even smoother and even better.
So I want to turn to some of the acts that have been introduced. And first, the Haitian group from Port-au-Prince. Julia, tell me a little bit about this particular group.
Well, Mouvement Expérience was founded in 1978, so 41 years ago. And they are really one of Haiti's most beloved bands. They play musique racine, which means roots music. So it's very much rooted in voodoo tradition, and as you mentioned earlier, with elements of more modern music mixed in rock and R&B. And they take their name from a voodoo priest named Boukman Douti, who led a famous ceremony in 1791 that is credited with sparking the Haitian Revolution.
So, and the kind of music they play, is it in then Creole, or tell me a little bit about the influences we're looking at?
Yes, it's in Creole, and It is based in the ceremonial drumming and song of voodoo religion of Haiti, which really is a syncretized, grew out of West African Catholic and Native Taino and Arawak theologies mixed together. And it's, it is really, the rites of voodoo are meant to restore the balance in the world. And this group is very much about a celebration of Haitian culture and bringing people together.
Now, there's also, I guess, a little bit of a political element to all of this, because I guess I think he's quoted as saying that it's to tell Haitian people to be proud of their culture. And as we know, there have been a series of dictatorships in the past. We saw this certainly in the 1990s and in up into the 2000s. How does this reflect, then, on what he's trying to do?
Well, the group actually has rebuffed politicians and political parties. Instead, I think they see themselves as focusing on being the voice of the people and pointing out injustices and you know, the needs of Haitians. They did actually go into exile for a while, a couple of decades ago. But have been back in Haiti now for quite some time.
Mm. Well, let's hear a little bit about of the little Haitian music.
Messieurs, dames, appréciez la vie. Pas quitter la chambre, prendre la piège. Messieurs, dames, respectez.
Indeed, you can hear a bit of the rock and a little bit of electric guitar there.
Yeah.
Let me just turn
and,
to... Yeah,
Don,
go ahead.
You know, there's one thing else that I wanted to mention about this group is we were very intent on including Haitian artists this year because I don't know if listeners are aware that there are 60,000 people of Haitian descent in Delmarva alone.
So we have a large Haitian population, and I think it was at one point at least a radio station of some kind. Mm-hmm. So yes, there are a serious presence that you see often, particularly over the immigration issue as well. We see them participating in a lot of that. I want to turn to Iraq and the music out of that and a particular kind of instrument. Tell me a little bit about this tradition, which I guess stretches back to about 5,000 years.
Yes, this is a musical tradition born in really the heart of Mesopotamia, and it centers on the oud, which is a fretless, short-necked Arabian lute that's central to Iraqi music, but also central to the whole Persian culture zone. It's an ancestor of the lute family of today, which includes the guitar.
And what does it? What can you describe it a little? Because I understand it's fretless. What kind of sound does it give? Do you think
it has a very kind of not quite like a banjo, but a kind of that woody kind of mellow sound. It's a beautiful instrument, and Rahim Ahaj is a true master of this tradition, whose personal story is really quite fascinating.
By the way, and I also had, I understand it has a slightly different tonal set of tones and so on in terms of compared to...
Oh, yeah. So in Western music, we have whole and half tones. So together there are 12 semitones. In the music from the Middle East, it is based on quarter tones. So there are 24 quarter tones, which sometimes to the Western ear, you know, gives it a bit of an unusual sound because the scale and the increments of the notes are much smaller. So, and the music is divided or presented in a series of makama or modes, and each makam is a particular scale and a particular melodic formula. And there are many, many of these, and they're even associated with certain moods or seasons, and then the performer, the player, will improvise upon these modes, and it is the ability to expand and improvise on these modes that is how you judge a master.
I understand that Rahim himself obviously gets a little tuned to politics in the sense that he was in Iraq, not to the liking of Saddam Hussein. Tell me a little bit about his history there.
Well, I mean, he was essentially a child prodigy who studied with legendary masters and was recognized as one of the world's foremost Udists before he ever left Iraq. But his political activities were not appreciated by Saddam's repressive regime. They put him in prison twice. He was tortured and he was beaten. And during the Gulf War, his mother sold almost everything she had to get him false documents to get him out of the country because it was rumored that there was going to be an assassination attempt.
Now, he also, I guess one of his key compositions is Why, which is about the Iran-Iraq War. Most of us, it sort of disappears from our radar screen, but it lasted some 8 years. It took a terrible toll, particularly in terms of the Iranians who were gassed by Saddam Hussein. Tell me a little bit about this this composition and who he dedicated it to.
Well, the composition, which he entitled Why, is based on a poem by a longtime friend of his who lost his legs in the Iran-Iraq War. And it did become rather an anthem for the resistance movement.
Now, he also has someone he plays with who is Iranian, ironically enough. Tell me a little bit about that fusion of those two people.
Yeah, Sarena Safati, excuse me, plays the santur, which is a Persian hammer dulcimer, and he is a celebrated artist in his own right. And they have recently, well, Rahim became a U.S. citizen. He emigrated was granted political asylum in 2000, became a citizen in 2008, and Sarena Safati is also living and teaching in the U.S. Since 2014. They recently, last year, released a recording called One Sky, and it was a reflection on the coming together of two nations who were previously sworn enemies. And the thrust of Rahim's music is that we should open our hearts to one another and to create more beauty together rather than destruction. And this collaboration is very much expressive of that.
Well, let's hear a little bit of their music.
Thank you.
quite an interplay there of notes back and forth. Fascinating. I want to turn to something maybe a little more traditional here in the United States, which, of course, is gospel music. Cornelia Armstrong from Virginia. Tell me a little bit about first her background.
Well, Armstrong still lives in the tiny hometown where she grew up, which was Newtown in King and Queen County, Virginia. Her father was a deacon in the church, and she served as minister of music, as a matter of fact, in this church for four decades. Her mother started the Harvey Family Singing Group with Cora and her sisters when they were kids, and she said when she was around the house, her mother was a really big fan of Mahalia Jackson and the Clara Ward singers, so she heard really some of the foundational powerful figures of gospel growing up. Her mother and father both sang in the church. And later on, she attended Virginia State University, and she directed the acclaimed VSU Gospel Chorale.
Mm. She also had, I guess, some health problems and relationship problems. Does that, do you think, play into the kind of music that she does?
Oh, I think it really informs her worldview and her music. She, of course, had this foundation, family foundation in the church. But when she, you know, got to a certain age, she led what she described as a rather hellacious life of drinking and partying and so on and so forth. Excuse me. Some health problems and a bad marriage and her father passing away got her to sort of rededicate herself to her faith and her music. And she is now pursuing a master's in divinity, and she is a minister.
And I guess one of the things I read was that described her as being sort of Aretha Franklin on a piano and Mahalia Jackson in her voice. Is that a good description?
Oh, my God. You know, it really is. I know that's high praise. And this was said by a Richmond musician and producer, Bill McGee. And he this is the quote, Aretha Franklin on piano, Mahalia Jackson with her voice, and Shirley Caesar with her style. And you don't, there's no higher praise than that. That's almost scary. So, but she's that good. And, I mean, she is a force of nature. And with her sisters singing in the group, backing her up, it is very, very powerful music.
And I understand that she writes, obviously, songs of her own, but also seems to certainly like the traditional songs, Amazing Grace for one.
Yeah, she does. I mean, she feels that they really connect with people. And many of the artists that we present at festivals do compose, but what is notable about the way they compose is they compose within the tradition. You know, it's a seamless addition to tradition as opposed to something really, really different.
Let's hear a little bit of it, Cora Harvey Armstrong, since we've given such a strong endorsement. Very, very traditional, but it's certainly outstanding gospel there. Very reminiscent of the African American church that we treasure here in the United States.
Yes, and I might add that it's Cora on piano as well as vocals.
Yeah, it's a remarkable. So finally, we want to turn to bluegrass. Tell me a little bit about the group, its background. I guess it's rooted in sort of Southwest Virginia, North Carolina, that kind of thing. Tell me a little bit about that.
remarkable about this group is, yes, they are rooted, their music is rooted in that Galax, Virginia, Mount Airy, North Carolina, kind of famous musical hotbed. And their story begins with a previous generation of two families. And it also connects very much with the story of migration from the mountains in the 20th century, particularly around the time of World War II, when so many people from the southern Appalachians moved up into Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, and environs, including Washington, D.C., and brought this music with them and kept it in these, you know, what were essentially migrant communities resettling in the Mid-Atlantic. So Danny Paisley, who plays guitar and is the lead vocalist for this group and just known for this amazing roots, rooty, rough, high lonesome kind of vocal that is, it just goes straight to your heart. It's just stabbed by it. Another primary figure in the band is T.J. Lundy, who is the fiddler. But the Paisley Lundy families, Bob Paisley and Ted Lundy, their fathers, were two transplants from the Galax, Mount Airy area. In the 1960s, they formed a band in Delaware called the Southern Mountain Boys. When Ted Lundy passed away, Bob renamed the group Southern Grass, and the group has been going now. It includes Danny's son now, 18-year-old son Ryan, representing the third generation of this two-family musical history.
And I understand that the fiddler in particular is a master of what's called the 50s bluegrass. What's that about?
Well, it's kind of a classic sound. I mean, bluegrass didn't really emerge until about 1945. Mm-hmm. So his sound harkens back to kind of that pioneering generation, the first generation of bluegrass players.
What do you think is distinct about this as opposed to, say, other bluegrass? I mean, I don't know what you've thought about that, but...
Bluegrass today, there's a really great range of styles within the genre, from very traditional, which has a lot of commonalities, I think, still with kind of old-time music, to a much more slick and contemporary style, where you can detect a lot of other influences from country music and other things coming into the music. And it's not a matter of is one better than the other, but there are all these different shades and tints of bluegrass music. This group is just, you know, really at the heart of the traditional sound.
Well, let's take a little listen to that traditional sound.
Slowly the long day. Within my cell I'm making plans to be at home with you again. These wasn't boys can't hold a dream and man.
And, you know, it's what strikes me is that there's this real kind of connection I can see between, you know, on the one hand, this very country kind of music with obviously other genres emerging, including blues. I mean, you can almost hear them being entangled, I think, in a song like this.
Yeah, and bluegrass, you know, as it was born in the mid 1940s. It was, you know, it really was incorporating elements of blues and ragtime and some jazz. It was all part of the kind of musical stew that bluegrass emerged from, as well as, of course, old-time string band music.
Right. I mean, I guess, and also, I guess, and even really sort of coming out of the 1930s with the Great Depression, obviously we're in the midst of the Second World War, but certainly the Great Depression took a very big toll on that area.
Oh, yes. And certainly that accounts when World War II was coming along. That accounts, and the work in the factories in the Mid-Atlantic accounts for a lot of that migration up here. There were jobs.
So, again, wanted to check in here. And, Caroline, again, so people want to be checking out, see what they might be able to do, maybe even hear some of this music. What should they be doing?
They should go to nationalfolkfestival.com, and you will be able to hear audio clips, check out bios, photos. We have video clips, as well as information about the festival. And we'll have schedules as we get much closer to the festival and things like that. But, you know, just listening to those clips, it made me think about the music that's going to be wafting through the air in the evening, and listening to Danny Paisley's voice, or listening to Raheem's oud, and just the myriad of sounds and just delights that we have in store for our festival goers. It just gets me excited every time we visit and get to chat about the artists that are coming and what's happening next.
But Julie, as a matter of fact, I guess in one of the press releases, you're talking about trying to broaden the kind of grassroots music that you have. Is that right?
Well, it's a message here about what is American culture? What are what are we today? Who are we today? We're all of this and more, and the festival wants to share that, wants to share the riches of America's musical culture and other manifestations, and have a chance for the American public to experience and appreciate our nation's heritage, you know?
Indeed. I mean, and you, as we heard, everything from Iraqi to Haitian and to, of course, traditional bluegrass, it is... reminds us
it's a big family.
It reminds us that we are indeed a nation of immigrants.
Yes, we are, and it's beautiful.
We've been speaking with Caroline O'Hare. She's the local manager for the festival here. And also on the phone with us is Julie Olin. She's the artistic director of the National Council for the Traditional Arts. Appreciate both of you chatting with us this morning.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.